March 5th, 2020, Nanaimo, British Columbia.
I am pleased to welcome Nanaimo, British Columbia, and Sir Oxman Stadium to play host to the 13th team in the West Coast League.
Nanaimo baseball, from the coal mines of Douglas in East Wellington to number 6 in Jingle Pot, from Departure Bay to Nanaimo Harbor, Gabriola, Wellington, Cassidy, and Extension. This is their story. This is Coal Ball.
Welcome, everybody, to another inning, inning number 11. That's right. We are in extra innings because what's a good baseball game like without not having some extra innings? Because you know that you're in it, the game's going and it's hot and you got a lot of great stuff happening. And just like a baseball game, Coal Ball is living. It's a living, breathing document. And this inning is no different than any of the others. We got an amazing guest, and that person joining us has an amazing background. I mean, I've spent time looking at their background, researching their background, and needless to say, this is one of these coaches that is bringing this team some great experience. And if I was a young athlete coming to play in Nanaimo this summer in 2022, in the inaugural season for the Nanaimo Night Owls, I would want to be playing for this coach with this background. So I think I've talked it up enough, but without further ado, we have the pitching coach for the inaugural season and your Nanaimo Night Owls, Gorman Heimuller. Coach, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Ben. I hope that with the extra innings, I hope we're not starting with a ghost runner at second. I hope it's just a clean inning.
You know, it's not, we're not doing Major League Baseball rules. We're not starting with a ghost runner. Though, I mean, I remember back in the day, probably like you, where, you know, out playing on the yard with your friends and not having enough players and you had your own ghost runners anyways.
Yeah. So. And, you know, and they'd started it in the minor leagues and I wasn't a big fan of it, but I think in the minor leagues with, you know, the moves you have to make when you have a long inning game, it does create a lot of moves. But I definitely in the major leagues would like to see it go back to playing extra innings.
Exactly. I would too. But coach, appreciate you joining us for this inning of Coal Ball. It's been a great series, a great history of Nanaimo. I've been to the place. I'm looking forward to getting up there this summer, but I've absolutely fallen in love with the city of Nanaimo and the people that are there and can't wait to get there. But you're going to be there. You're going to be strong. You're going to be going. But to get there, we need to tell your history, your past, the things that you've done as not only a player, but also as a coach. You're from Los Angeles, California. You went to St. Bernard High School. You started off playing baseball, I think, in Little League for your father, Gorman Sr. Talk to me a little bit about that. Like, where did you get this love for baseball?
You've done your homework. That's pretty good. I grew up in L.A. My dad was my my coach from the time I was 9 in Little League. And back then, you couldn't even play any Little League till you're 9 years old. From 9 till I was 16, he was born and raised in St. Louis, a big St. Louis Browns fan, and just loved baseball. And he was left-handed. I'm left-handed. It's just something that I from as long as I can remember, just fall in love with the game and looking back on it, I just feel so blessed and lucky they got my dad to be my coach for that many years. It was a lot of fun. Might have been some days when I was younger where I might not have loved it that much, but when after it all said and done, I'm so happy that we were able to do it.
You obviously went to some games with your dad. What was that experience like? Was he like walking you through the plays, kind of talking to you about it, or were you just kind of sitting there enjoying the game and just having a great time being with your pops?
Well, I think everything you just said, the first, you know, we used to pick Dodger games out in February, trying to hit almost every team. One memory is probably 1963 when I was not even 8 years old yet. And he took me, he was, like I said, from St. Louis, and that was Stan Musial's last year. And so I remember sitting way high up and him showing me this is Stan Musial. I can picture his stance as a little kid to this day and how cool that was. And then after that, going down to on the field boxes, watching the Dodgers play. And at that time, when I was 10, 11 years old, Sandy Koufax was my, you know, it was either Koufax God. I wasn't sure who was higher than who at that time. I just lived to watch him pitch, and I got a chance to see him pitch live a number of times when I was younger. And those memories are things, you know, I can't remember what I had for lunch yesterday, but I can remember some of those things 40, 50 years ago, like it was yesterday.
Let me guess, you imitated Sandy Koufax when you played either in Little League or kind of with your buddies.
No question about it. And, you know, I'm 6'4", and when I was probably 12 years old, I was probably 6'1". I was taller than anybody else, and they didn't have a uniform to fit me. So they got me my own uniform, and numbers went from 1 to 16. I had number 32.
That's so great.
Try to imitate him, no doubt.
Yeah. And the reason why I say that is every person who is really involved with baseball that much has that one player or two that they imitate. And for me, it was Greg Maddux. That's who I grew up just loving. Like when I could understand the game of baseball and comprehend it and see what perfection was, it was Greg Maddux for me.
No question. I loved watching him pitch. He pitched. And then with the Phillies, when I was with the Phillies, as a coordinator, Jamie Moyer was there, and he was kind of the left-handed Maddux in the way he pitched. And I never got drafted, and I couldn't break a pane of glass in my fastball. So I had to basically trick him and change speeds and locate my fastball. So Maddux is, I mean, if a young pitcher doesn't just want to model himself after Maddux, there's something wrong.
Yeah. So let's talk about your dad, because I want to focus a little bit more time on your dad. So your dad was a coach. What else did he do professionally? Like what was his background?
Well, he played high school. Then he got sick in St. Louis. The war came. He's also a musician, very good piano player. Then worked in. He's actually during the war. He was assistant manager at Grauman's Chinese Theater. And in Hollywood, and then he got into sales when I was born, and supported us. But he was always there for me, baseball wise. I mean, he always watched my games. I remember when I got called to the big leagues. And there was no cell phones back then, but it was in Baltimore. And he had a friend that was in Baltimore, so they had an open phone line during the whole game, so he could listen to the game. And just total. I mean, like me, baseball junkie, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. But in my recollection, I never remember him ever pushing me or making me do. So I loved it, and the fact he was there was great.
What's everybody's got a leadership kind of quality that they learn from, like their parents. And for me, for example, one of the leadership qualities that I learned from my dad was look, take a step back, let them learn on their own and develop as a human while providing some insight, some information if they come to you asking those questions. And so it's something that from my dad that I've learned and that I'm carrying on to this day with my own two children. So what's some sort of leadership quality that you learned from your dad from the time, you know, playing baseball or outside of baseball?
Well, the biggest thing I learned was, you know, treating everybody equally. He would, you know, he was very, it's my dad, so I'm pretty biased, but I don't remember. He was very likable. He would have an opinion, but he would listen to your opinion. And the thing that I learned was just not, you know, to always treat somebody that the way you want to be treated. And it's something I've tried to carry on through my career. You know, I've never, ever, whether it's working with 10-year-olds or these college kids or pros, I never wanted to ever have me being up here and them being down there. I always want to try to talk to them on an even level. And he was really good at that.
Mm-hmm. So in high school, you know, you obviously you played baseball. Was it varsity that time, or like how is your baseball career going in high school?
In high school, I was good hitter. I liked to hit and I could pitch, but I was never really possessed a really good fastball. But I was able to change speeds. I always seemed to be successful more than I wasn't. And I wasn't successful a lot, but it's, from early on, and I can remember the one thing I do love, and that's something I think you'd have to be if you're going to play for a while, is the love to compete. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean you're going to win every time, but that desire to want to go out there, and when the game starts, your feeling is you're going to go out there and be successful. And it's something that I think it's helped me in my career. I think, you know, I was told by many people I wasn't good enough. In fact, in high school, my senior year, you know, I went to a Catholic high school, and we had to write out our vocation, what we got to do when we grow up. And so I put baseball player. And so the sister that was the nun that was a teacher, you know, the class was over, and she goes, she called my name out. You stay after class. I need to talk to you. And so, you know, she sits me down. She goes, I know this is what you want to be, but you got to be more realistic than this. She goes, this is not something that's going to happen. I want you to pick something that you want to, you know, you really think that is very doable. And I just said, well, I want to be a baseball player. That's something I've always, my whole life. And so, you know, Sister Patricia, wherever you are, 45 years later, here I am still doing it.
There you go. At what point was pitching like your kind of passion? Like what point, or is it like you decided like, okay, pitching's definitely the one area where I want to focus primarily on?
Well, I think like a lot of kids that, and I'm a big believer, if a guy can hit and pitch, you do both in high school. And when it got to the chance to go to college, I mean, I knew my ability as a hitter. I could hit the ball, somewhat power, but couldn't run. And I knew as a left-handed pitcher, my competition is cut by 60%. And so I thought that would be the best path to maybe playing college, definitely, and always having that dream to maybe get a chance to play professional baseball. So that was kind of dictated by the recruiting coach that asked me to, you know, eventually go into Cal Poly, and it turned out to be the right thing.
Mm-hmm. I like to ask a lot of people that I interview this particular question, especially with somebody that has your level of experience, either as a player and as a coach. If you could go back and tell your younger high school, college player something that you would have done a little differently, whether it be preparation through playing different sports, maybe focusing on a little education, not saying that you had a problem with education, but focusing on something specifically, what would it be and why?
I mean, going back to myself and yeah, doing it. Well, I mean, this is not something I'm proud of, but when you go back to education, you know, back then you had to have a C average to play sports. My parents upped that to a B average. And looking back on it now, it's totally wrong. I was young and stupid, but in baseball, I wanted to be the absolute best. And I worked my butt off to try and be the best I could be, where back in high school, if I could get a B and not work that hard, I was okay with that. Whereas if I'd have tried to have the same ethic I had as a baseball player into my student, and I think I would have been capable of. I do know I was capable of doing, you know, getting more A's and being a lot better. I wasn't a bad student, but I would settle for a B without putting a lot of effort into it. And in a lot of the classes, that was the way it was. And back then, it's okay. Well, I got my B. I'm better than average. I'm okay with that. But I wanted to be the best on the baseball field. I just wish I'd have had that same ethic.
Okay, there. So you'd like to have what your work ethic on the field translate over into the classroom.
If I had a chance to go back again, but yeah. I can't. And then I get to college and you realize, oh man, I can't do what I did in high school and be able to survive. I gotta apply it more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. But you end up going to Cal Poly. What made you choose Cal Poly?
They offered me a scholarship. I went to, I had, and that was, you know, today's world, you know, cause I work with a lot of kids and you get kids that are sophomores in high school, committing to a school, which I think is kind of funny when you don't even know how these kids going to develop. But it wasn't until after my senior year, I was really planning on going to junior college, and I was playing a Babe Ruth game, and the coach from Cal Poly saw me. We took a trip up there in the summertime. I loved the area and the fact that they wanted me, and I had a partial scholarship the first year, and then a full scholarship next 3 years.
Yeah. Saw that you played with Ozzie Smith there for a little bit.
Well, all 4 years. We came the same time, and I tell people that was the highlight of my college career. So Ozzie Smith's my shortstop. One thing I did, but he was unbelievable. As great a player as he is, he was that good a guy.
And does he doing his backflips in college too?
Yes, he was. And a great trivia question. And I don't have anything to back it up, but his high school teammate for 4 years was Eddie Murray.
Wow.
And I got to believe that there hasn't been a time where you've had two high school players on the same year be Hall of Famers on the same team.
Yeah, especially with Eddie Murray. Jeez, oh my God. Ed Ozzie Smith, amazing talent.
I know.
Yeah. So what was your – talk a little bit about what your experience was like at Cal Poly, because I know kind of towards the end you didn't get some advice from your coach that you were hoping to get.
Well, you've read that article. There's a couple of articles I've talked about that. But, and the funny part about it is, you know, after my senior year, I took a line drive during batting practice, put me out for about a month. And at the end of the year, we were in playoffs. I just didn't pitch that much. And I asked my coach if I could have a chance to play pro ball. And he had played pro ball, and he just said no. He just flat out said no. And the only pro baseball I could see was the Dodgers and Angels in L.A. I didn't know any minor league teams. So that fueled me a little bit to want to really have a chance. But I didn't, maybe I'm not good enough. And in the meantime, in my first 3 years in college, I'd go up to Canada and play in the summertime. Kind of it's similar to what the Nanaimo League is, except it wasn't an all college league. We had four college players around a bunch of farmers and hockey players. And it was a Saskatchewan Major Baseball League.
Was it like barnstorming kind of?
It was a league. It was an actual league. In fact,
Jim Swanson
played for the coach that was in the league in Saskatoon, was the coach of Saskatoon when I was playing in there.
Really?
Yeah. And it was fun because I not only pitched, but I got to play the outfield and hit, and it was a blast. And so I did that for 3 years. And so after my senior year, I didn't get drafted. But I had to go chance to go play in Alberta, Red Deer, Alberta, which is like in between Calgary and Edmonton. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, you know what? I'll just be my last hurrah. I'll go up there, have a good time. And the biggest thing was back in Calgary then, Calgary was a rookie ball team. I think it might have been the Cardinals. I'm not positive. But anyway, we had a night off, and it was about 80 miles to Calgary. And a bunch of us went and saw this rookie ball game, which I'd never been to before. And I'm watching it. I'm going to myself. I'm going, you know, I may not be able to pitch the big leagues, but I know I can pitch this right here. And that kind of gave me a little bug to try and get looked at. And you know, to make this long story a little shorter, I got a chance to, I beat this team in Rapid City, South Dakota in a tournament in Canada. And they asked me to go pitch for them in the NBC tournament in Wichita, which is a big thing where people could see me. And right before that, I got a tryout in Calgary for the Giants, San Francisco Giants. A guy, a bird dog scout in Red Deer, gave my name. So I went down there and threw for him. And the guy said, you know, you look good, but we only got 3 weeks left. There's no room right now, but give me your name and number. I'll get you into spring training in 1978. This is 77. And so now I'm getting ready to go play for the Rapid City team. And the guy goes, go book your flight in Calgary and then meet us in Wichita. So I went to do that. And all the airlines were on strike in Canada. And so I'm like, God, this is my only chance. I wasn't very smart. I looked at a map and I got my baseball bag, my backpack, and I hitchhiked 500 miles from Red Deer, Alberta to Great Falls, Montana. Again, long story. I would never advise that. I had my guardian angel looking after me, but I had a, so now I get to the, through all that, I get to the Denver airport, getting ready for my plane to Wichita. And all of a sudden my name comes over the white phone because Gorman Heimler comes to the white phone. I pick it up and they go, call your father immediately. And I'm like, you know, somebody died. And so tell a story to the kids. I said, back then you used to put coins into this device and you press buttons. You can make a phone call that way. They have no idea what that is. So my dad said, somebody at Candlestick Park was looking for you. So I called Candlestick Park. And they said, hey, we got the reports on you. We had a pitcher get hurt last night in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Can you be there tomorrow? I said, sure. I had no idea how I was getting there. I go, sure. So I get to Wichita, and the team that flew me there, and I tell them the story. And they go, man, that's why you're here. And they flew me there. And it's right out of Bull Durham. I mean, I'm sitting in this empty locker room waiting for the team to come back. And I'm like, the GM picked me up and he bought me a hamburger. That was my bonus for signing. This GM bought me a hamburger. So that was Paul Molitor's rookie year because we played them in the playoffs. And that's how I got my first contract. And then in 1978, go to spring training with the Giants. And a week in the spring training, they traded for Vida Blue and traded a bunch of prospects. So next thing I know, I'm in a double-A roster and I made a double-A team my first year. And then that's how my career started.
Now, you also have an interesting thing that first year. I think, if I'm correctly, based on my research, a manager by the name of Frank Robinson helped teach you a pickoff move, if I'm correct, from what I read.
It's fairly close, fairly close. What happened was, that was always a weapon for me. I always had a good pickoff. Something I learned from my dad before I could even have started to go to a stretch, and something I picked up, and it was a weapon. I mean, that first full year in 78, I think I picked off 27 guys as a reliever. I mean, I had a win and a save without throwing a pitch that year because I just come in and pick somebody off, which showed you how many base runners I had. I had a lot of practice. So in 78, 79, so I had a reputation for having a good move. So 1981 comes, a good year in 1980. So spring training 81, Frank Robinson's the manager. So I get a call, and Jimmy Lefever was one of his coaches. And I knew Jimmy from when I was like 9 years old. He had a camp in Catalina Island that I went to. They were inviting me to big league camp. But after I was there a while, they invited me to big league camp, which was great. But I think they also there because they wanted me to see if I could help other left-handers with their move. And so Frank Robinson, he was great to me. Had me out there with all the lefties and, had Al Holland, Gary Lavelle, Vida Blue, all trying to work on the move. And to me, it's not every left-hand is going to have a good move. I mean, my delivery is a little, you wouldn't teach my delivery. It was more deceptive than really picture perfect. But that's the story behind Frank Robinson. I think that's one of the reasons they brought me to camp, which I didn't know that at the time, but it was just still kind of cool. They did. And then they sent me down after I got into the game, did well. They sent me down to AAA, which I thought I was going to be at. Then they released me after my first start. And then I went around looking for other clubs.
You, from what I was reading, you were a little shocked that you were released so soon following spring training.
That's, you know, I mean, that's, I was released after that by a team, which I expected. This just blew me away. I mean, I was devastated. I had no idea. In fact, the farm director's name was Jack Schwartz. He was probably 75 then. And so I go in there, I mean, the guy, Rocky Bridges was the manager, and he goes, you know, go see Jack. And I knew right away what it was when he said that. And so he had my plane ticket right there. And I just said, you know, explain how, you know, blah, didn't have enough room. And I said, well, I handed him my plane ticket. I said, well, can you give me the money, please? So I'm going to look around for other teams. And I think I can still pitch. And he looked at me, he goes, yeah, he goes, it's too bad. He goes, we just have too many right-handers. And so I looked at him and I said, just give me the money. Oh, by the way, I'm left-handed. So he didn't even know I was left-handed when I got released. And and then Doyle Alexander and Greg Minton were really, I mean, everybody, all of, I mean, those guys are great, Vita Blue, but I stayed with Greg Minton until I got a job, went around all the camps, went to the A's a couple of times. And what turned out was I saw a guy at the A's office. And we looked at each other and like we knew each other. And it was the coach of that Rapid City team that wanted me to pitch for him years ago. And he goes, what are you doing? I go, I just got released from the Giants with big league camp. Well, he knew the pitching coach from the Giants. He called. He goes, hey, I got good reports. You didn't know you got released, blah, blah, blah. And so I get a tryout. They throw me in a game the day before spring training was over at AA. And I pitched well. And they sent me to West Haven, Connecticut. And had a really good year there. 82 was just a so-so year. Went to 83, and that's where I got a chance to go to the big leagues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you make your – well, you played West Haven for the West Haven A's, and then you went out to Tacoma, Washington, and played for the Tacoma Tigers, who are now the Tacoma Rainiers.
Right.
Said you had a pretty good time that time. You posted a career-high 12 wins with a 2.73 ERA. So you did really, really well, you know, going and playing in the Pacific Northwest. And then, you know, now you're going to be in Southwest Canada. I mean, it's pretty much similar climate in ways. What was it like for playing in just south of Seattle when you played for Tacoma?
Oh, it was, well, it was just, for me, it was just AAA. It was getting to the next level, and the next level was big leagues. And and you'd like this. My second start, I started up in Edmonton was my first start, and then I started against Portland, the Beavers in Portland. And the opposing pitcher was Louis Tion, and Willie Horton was a DH. And it was because back then it's probably before your time, but there was a show called Laverne and Shirley, and one of the actors in there was a GM or part owner of the Portland Beavers back then. And he brought, in fact, they had a Happy Day softball game there where I got a picture of the Fonz and Ron Howard and all that stuff.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah, it was fun.
That's really cool. And that's at, well, they used to call it PGE Park. Now it's Providence Park. And but it was a Multnomah County Civic Stadium at the time, Civic, I believe it was. Stadium. Yeah. So, I mean, it's been interesting. I did a whole series on that particular stadium. And you know, prior to that was Vaughn Street. That's probably one of the, looking at the history of baseball in Portland, that's probably one of the places that would have been kind of cool to go see when it was around.
Yeah, it was going after a game. Well, coaching there, especially, it was as a player, but it was the downtown area was great. It was great to walk around.
So you made your major league debut in 83 in July. Saw that you, if this is correct, struck out Cal Ripken Jr. in your first inning of your first start.
Yeah, I was, I was pitching the day before in Tacoma against the Dodgers. In fact, I was on the training table, getting my arm rubbed down, getting ready to go warm up. And the manager comes in and says, hey, you're not pitching tonight. You're going to pitch tomorrow. I go, why? He goes, you're pitching tomorrow in Baltimore. So this is like 6 o'clock. I'm on a red eye by 11 to get to Baltimore and to pitch that night. And they didn't even know that at that time, Mike Norris was one of the pitchers and he came up sore. It was real sudden. the timing of it. I mean, if I had pitched the day before, I would never got a shot. And then when I got up there, they didn't have enough letter to spell my name. So my name was spelled wrong the whole rest of the road trip.
And I said, oh, really?
Yeah. I said, I don't care. I've been waiting for this for, 8 years. You can spell it wrong the whole time. And they only had threes and ones left. So I was number 13 with my name spelled wrong. And I was loving every minute of it.
Do you have a, is there a picture of that hanging around somewhere?
I do.
Oh, that is awesome. I'd love to see that.
Yeah. I'll show it to you on my phone. I'll show it to you when we're up in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Excellent. Excellent. But you had you had your first start, but then going into your second start, I think from what I read, according to your father, it was probably one of his proudest moments. You had your shutout. You struck out Rod Carew and Reggie Jackson.
That was later on. My second start was in Boston, right after the Baltimore game.
Okay.
And then the Baltimore game, it was actually, I went into the bottom of the eighth, losing 1-0, and the only run was first and third, one out, and just a two hopper to shortstop, and he couldn't decide whether he should have just gone to the bag and threw him out, and he hesitated. He got to the bag and threw it into the stands, so the run counted; it was earned. But now I get to the bottom of the eighth, and I had Cal Ripken on first and Eddie Murray up, and he hit. I mean, I threw a screwball. That's what gave me a chance. And so he missed some, and I made him look really bad. Had two strikes, and he just fouled one off, another screwball. And then Mike Keith, the catcher, says, "Come in with a fastball." I go, that's a good idea. And didn't quite get it in enough. And it wasn't the longest home run I ever gave up, but it was the fastest one. So I had Cal Ripken chase. He chased a screwball about a foot off outside for my first strikeout. And then 2 years later in 85, I was in Baltimore's camp and actually went out with a buddy of mine and Billy Ripken and Cal Ripken. And, it was pretty cool. I mean, they'd never seen me before, and I had the advantage, and he chased one, but it was just a dream come true getting the opportunity. But the game you're talking about was probably a month later, and it was in Oakland. Hmm. And my dad made a so-called business trip to go up there and see it. To lead off the game, I struck out Rod Carew, and there's only one way I can strike out Rod Carew, because he's not going to swing and miss.
Yeah.
He's got too good an eye to take a third called strike. So how do you think I struck him out?
I don't know, man. That guy's hard to strike out.
He is leading off the game. He tried to bunt the third strike and fouled it off.
Oh, no way.
So when that happened, I'm like, oh, this might be an omen right here.
Wow.
And so that's how I struck him out. Then I did get Reggie twice on screwballs in the dirt, getting ahead of him. That lineup was, Doug DeSensei's was the third, Bobby Gritch was the second, Fred Lynn was in center, Brian Downey was DH, Bob Boone was a catcher. It was a good lineup, really good lineup. And I threw under 100 pitches. And the thing of today, I had two complete games, and I had one in the eighth inning, the Yankees I got to the seventh, Twins I got to the seventh. And today, I probably wouldn't even get past the fourth or fifth. Mm. But back then, if the manager, they didn't have all this information. If his eyes, told him that you were throwing good, he left you in there.
Yeah. So, were you a little bit intimidated playing against some of these really, really good ball players? Or were you just like, whatever, I'm just going to go out there and I'm just going to kill it?
You know what? Probably more of that right there. I was probably too stupid to be intimidated. It was like, I felt like I was playing with house money. I mean, they were told me I couldn't do it. And was I nervous? Sure. But looking back on it, it was an excited nervous. I wanted, I got here. What's the worst thing that can happen? I'm not successful, but when I'm pitching Yankee Stadium, I remember turning around, seeing the monuments there and getting able to, pitch against Dave Winfield, and that was Manny's rookie year, and Billy Martin was the manager, and who he was the manager with the A's in spring training 82 when I was there.
Yeah. So Jacob Kornheiser writes this book called A Cup of Coffee Club. And I know that there was a piece mentioned in another different article that I read. And you felt like you were beyond that cup of coffee club because you had gotten a little bit more time in the majors than some of those guys that they talk about in that book. But my point that I'm getting to is that it clearly probably went by pretty quickly for you, but the experiences alone that you had there, what's your biggest takeaway from that time when you played in the majors? Like, what's the biggest takeaway from you at that point? And what was probably your most memorable experience other than the big strikeout?
When I was coaching, I would tell, and I think it's that way every level. If I get to A ball, you want to get to double A and you think you can pitch in double A, but until you get that first out, you're really not sure. And then you're in double A, you want to get to triple A and you think you can pitch there, but until you get that opportunity to do it, you're not really sure. Well, for me, the biggest takeaway was that I could compete there without question. I could compete there. And I've kidded around a lot. I've used this where, I did an NFL, I had a cup of coffee. I had a thermos of coffee because I had a little more, a little more time than that. And then the biggest memory still goes back. Just getting there is a dream come true. But going back to that game where my dad flew up, and after the game was over, when I shut out the Angels, I'm walking in the locker room and saw a security guard there. I said, "My dad is here and he's waiting. Can he come down to the locker room?" And he goes, "I'll go get him." So I go to my locker and I had all these microphones in my face talking to me and stuff. And I'm talking about the game. All of a sudden I look and there's my dad watching me. And that is, without question, I'll never forget that, as long as I live. That was, and then I stayed at the hotel in Oakland and we went out to the bar there afterwards, and a lot of players, I'm introducing some players and coaches, and it's just a proud moment for him. But that look that, it was pretty cool. That's the thing that my most memory, performing and doing well, it's some things I'll never forget. And I've got, I got to keep some of the videos, but that moment that got to share with my dad was probably the best.
I'm sure he gave you a big hug and probably told you how proud he was of you. But beyond it being proud, if you don't mind sharing, and if you can remember, what were some words that he said to you, like after that, when you just got
I remember him saying, I always knew you could do it. Probably one thing I remember. And that he was proud and you could tell. And then when I got to coaching, this is before he had a stroke when he was 72 or 73, but he came up and saw me when I was coaching at Visalia and we played catch on the field. He was 70. And just like we used to when we were from time, he used to throw batting practice to me and he used to catch me until I was about, I'll never forget it. I bounced one and it hit him and that's it. I'm done. And I was probably about 15. And that's about the time I quit catching kids too. So that's why, I'm not getting down here anymore.
I remember, just a quick funny story. I remember, and I've said this many a times. I remember one time, I was out playing. My last time my brother caught for me, because my dad never really did, but my dad was sitting in the living room and we were playing catch and we're out behind the house and I threw the ball and it went right through the window and landed like right by my dad. He was so pissed.
Oh, I broke many a window.
Yeah.
In the garage, so, you put a piece of wood on it. I'm tired of pricing the window. We're not.
Yeah. That's a great experience being able to like go out on the field and at a later age for your dad and play catch with them. I mean, that's a very memorable experience. Did you give him the ball afterwards so he could take it home with him?
Yeah. He had a collection and then when he had his stroke, he was still very, he was alert. He had a hard time expressing it, but I gave him, I got my first year coach was 87 when the Twins won a World Series. So I got a World Series ring. So I gave that to him and he wore it every single day until he passed away.
Yeah. Yeah. I was reading that you had given your dad, your World Series ring and I'm sure he was like, look at this, look at this.
He was pretty pumped about it.
Well, you was it in late 83? I think you got sent back down to AAA in Tacoma. But my understanding is somewhere along the line there, your final pitch as a major leaguer, you were pitching in Boston. Huh? You're pitching in Boston. I'm a big Boston fan, by the way, but you were pitching in Boston in Fenway against Jim Rice in the 12th inning, and you give up a grand slam in the 12th inning against Jim Rice. Do you remember that moment and what that was like?
No, not at all. this was 1984. 83, I finished year in the big leagues, 84, you know, I was on the roster, had a good spring training, and the manager, Steve Boros, called me in and said, you know, you're having a great spring training. We're going to send you down because they rule five the guy that they didn't want to lose. So they kept him up there. I mean, he basically said, you deserve to be here, but we're going to keep this kid, which didn't make me real happy. So I got sent down, and I got called back up, and I was mostly just a mop-up guy, basically. Mm-hmm. And so the game I got into Boston, it was the 4th of July. And I didn't know it was going to be my last game at the time, obviously. But I came in the game in the 7th inning to face Bill Buckner, who was one of my favorite Dodgers when I was in college. And so I got him out, pitched the 8th and 9th, and I think it was the 11th inning, was the grand slam. So I pitched good. I pitched into the 10th. And it's still tied up. We had the bases loaded, one out. And the manager says, if we score a run, our closer's in. I said, great. Next pitch, double play. Mm-hmm. So I got to go back out and gave up a hit. And then they sacked in the second. In fact, a hit was a line drive off the Green Monster, and they made it a single. and so Joe Morgan was our second baseman, and they sacked in the second. I pick it up, throw it to Joe Morgan at first, right? Just hits his glove and he drops it. So now it's first and second, nobody out. Glenn Hoffman, who I later worked with the Dodgers and the Padres, he bunts in the second and third. We walk Dwight Evans intentionally to get Jim Rice. And I get behind 2-1. I throw a fastball away and he hits one to right center. And I knew right away the game was over. I'm just saying, just stay in the park. So only one run counts instead of four. And, you know, the short bullpen.
Yep. Yeah,
Bob Stanley, the reliever, caught it in his hat right off over the wall.
It's only it's not that far.
No, it was high, and just cleared it. And so, you know, so I got that going for me. My last pitch in the big leagues, grand slam. And so once he got to the Hall of Fame, I go, well, at least I gave it up to the Hall of Famer. And the you know, funny part of the story is probably 83, 94, maybe 20 years later or 18 years later, I'm coaching in Connecticut and Bob Stanley's coaching in Binghamton, New York. Introduced myself and I told him, I said, you caught my last pitch in the big leagues. He looked at me like, what the heck are you talking about? And I explained the whole thing to him. And he just started laughing. So another 5 years go by. He's with the Giants now, and I'm now with the Phillies, and we're in Connecticut, and I'm walking in for BP, and all of a sudden I can see he sees me, and he starts tapping this guy behind the turtle, and you can see he's telling the whole story again.
Oh, man. You know, Fenway is relentless when it comes to it. It must have been clearly rocking on that, and you just probably is like, okay, I gotta get out of here.
And the thing, and, you know, like I said, I didn't know it was going to be my last game. We finished a road trip in Milwaukee. And then they sent me down after, right before the All-Star break, and I never got a chance to get back up there. And, you know, like I said, the one thing I took away, I could compete there. Would I like to get more time up there? No question about it. But mm-hmm. I'm thankful for the time I did have.
But clearly, you know, with the experience that you had, you got to face some Hall of Fame talent, any way you look at it. Not a lot of people can say that they got to face Hall of Famers. What one player that you faced pitching that you really enjoyed, like, facing them?
Well, Reggie was fun. In fact, that my first game against Reggie, it was a day game in Anaheim, and you know our dugout was in the first base dugout, but the bullpen was in left field. So I got done warming up, and I'm walking behind home plate, and he's talking to somebody by the dugout. And all of a sudden, he yells at me, goes, "Hey," he goes, "take it easy on me. I'm 38 years old. It's a day game after a night game. Take it easy on me." I just didn't respond. I'm going, "Oh, this is Reggie Jackson time." And I got back to the dugout, and I go, "If I'd have been quick enough," I said, "Hey, I'm a 28-year-old rookie. You take it easy on me." But yeah, he was. And then another one that's a Hall of Famer that is, I'll always remember, is Robin Yount, mm-hmm. who that was my second complete game where I beat the Brewers. And that was Harvey's wall bangers back then. They, I mean, Robin Yount, Paul Molitor, Cecil Cooper, Ben Ogilvie, Ted Simmons, who's Hall of Famer now. But he went 0-for-4 off me. Yeah, but he hit a line drive to second, hit one right in front of the 390 sign in center field. And I took it as a compliment and maybe the best quotes, but he said after the game, he goes, "He's easy to hit. He just gets you out."
Yeah. And
so I took that as a nice compliment.
That's a good compliment. What was your favorite, like as a player, what was your favorite stadium to play in?
Again, just being a lifetime, almost lifetime minor leaguer, just being up there. But I've got to say, to say I pitched in Fenway and Yankee Stadium is really cool, and it had some character. The nicest park at the time that I thought back then, 83, was by Kansas City. It was a beautiful park. Oakland's the same park it is today. the only good thing about Oakland is we always said, if you pitch there a whole year, that you could probably put at least two or three innings of scoreless ball that would have been foul balls in the stands, because there's so much room in foul territory that you got some outs there. But other than that, it was bad back then. And that's why they want to get out of there.
Mm-hmm. So you make it, you transition from a player to a coach. What was that transition like for you, going from a player to a coach at that point?
It was unexpected. I never really thought about really coaching. And Charlie Manuel was my manager in 85, my last manager, 85, 86, with the Twins. And at that time, in fact, that year in 86, Billy Beane was our right fielder, the money ball guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And Charlie was my manager at the end of the year, because at that time, the Twins had no pitching coaches in A-ball or double-A. It was just a manager back then. That's the manager that did everything. And so he asked me after the season, he goes, "Would you be interested in coaching?" And I'm like, "Wait, are you telling me I can't pitch anymore?" He goes, they started laughing. He goes, "No, I'm just saying, if you want to, I put your name in. I think you can do it." So I thought about it. And for me, if I was going to play, I would have to go to play winter ball, which I had a job lined up in Dominican. And I also had an offer to go coach and play in Australia. And so I had to decide whether I wanted to get into coaching or keep playing. And from the cross country trip from Toledo to California, we decided to go try coaching. It was in California. I was living in California at the time. I didn't like it. Then I'll get on with the rest of my life. And the transition was, it was easier because once I made that commitment, I never once afterwards go, "Should, I think I could still pitch," which I probably thought I could, but I made that, mm-hmm. I made that decision. The hardest part was throwing BP without a catcher, because I'd never done it before. Mm-hmm. But I did enjoy right away, and that's what kind of has kept me in it. I did enjoy working with the players and trying to get the most out of each pitcher's ability. And I'm a big believer in, I've had coaches my lifetime that were the opposite. I don't think there's many today, but I always believe that if I have 12 pitchers, 12 pitchers don't adjust to me. I adjust to each individual pitcher and find out what it takes to get that guy better. It might be 12 different approaches,
mm-hmm.
but that's a challenge. And that's a fun part about it that I really, really like.
Did you have a hard time? Like, obviously you were coaching, but then that you still had that player mentality. Did you have a little bit of like separation problems between like, okay, I'm a former ball player and I remember what it was like being that player, and now I'm a coach, so I have to look at this from a different lens? Did you have a like a little bit of a transition
Time
frame for him?
Maybe in the beginning, but to this day, and it's been 40 years, when I forget what it was like to be out there, good and bad, it's time for me to get out. And I think that approach, you know, it's not that easy. The game isn't that easy. It's based on failure. Pitching isn't easy. If it was that easy, they wouldn't be giving somebody $40 million a year to do it, because everybody could do it. And so there is definitely a mindset that you have to have short-term memory, and you have to believe you're good, even if it means you're getting your butt handed to you. You just, okay, it's over with. Now I got to worry about it next time. But the transition from player to coach, I think, wasn't as hard as I thought it was going to be, but I think I tried to use it to my advantage, to where I was close to still playing, where I could relate to things to these young players.
Mm-hmm. Well, you start off in the California League with the Vasilla Oaks from 87-ish to 89. And that's where the Twins won in 87, the World Series. And I know we talked about the World Series ring. And then in 90, you move over with still within the Twins farm system, you move over to the Orlando Suns in the Southern League. Looks like that year you guys made it to the finals in 90. Talk to me a little bit about that particular team and, you know, what that team was like for you.
Well, Ron Gardenhire was manager, and Gardy and I, you know, we'd known each other, but we played against each other, and it was a fun year. And then you look back on it, and these are names, you know, you might not even know because you're young, but I mean, we had, pitching wise, we had Denny Nagel, who pitched a lot of years in the big leagues.
Yep. Denny Nagel. Yep.
Willie Banks pitched in the big leagues. Richard Garst was a big reliever with Boston. Pat Mahomes, who I coached Pat Mahomes. That's his son, the quarterback for the team. Yep. I coached him for 3 years. Scott Erickson, who had a really good major league career.
Yep.
Jeff Rebele was a shortstop, had a good big league career. Chuck Knobloch was second base.
Oh, wow.
Jarvis Brown got to the big leagues. Lenny Webster got to the big leagues. Chon Gilbert got to the big leagues. So we had a lot of guys that Willie Banks, another pitcher, we had a lot of guys that made it to the big leagues off that team. And we went to the best of five series, and we lost to the Royals double A team in the fifth game. But we had a really good team.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I've noticed about single A and double A, that's where you get, they know a lot, some players, they jump from double A to, you know, if they're good enough, double A to the majors. And even there are a couple who went from high A to the majors, most notably recently Julio Rodriguez, for example, made that jump this year. You just explained it. There's a lot of really good talent, not just from America, but there's also, international players too. Were there any really good international players on that team at that time?
Let me think about that. Not on that team. Well, Richard Garces from Venezuela. I mean, he got the big leagues fast. He had a really nice career. Player wise, I can't remember that year in '90 of them being. Position player wise, I know in when I coached in Portland in '91, I know Sammy Sosa was in Vancouver with the White Sox, but it wasn't there. The Latin player wasn't as there. It's so many today, and I mean, when I was with the Padres for the last 7 years, I probably went to Dominican 35 times, and got to know a lot of those guys and the talent. Not just the talent, but the work ethic of trying to get off the island, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really passionate. I mean, you go and you don't see it that much in the States anymore, but you just driving, going to the stadium, you just see parks all over where little kids are playing baseball. I mean, they're just pickup games. And that's what I did when I was a kid. And of course there were no video games. And so, we had to go out and play.
Yeah. Same here. I guess my kind of follow on question to that is like, what for you, what was the biggest difference that you could see between the international players and the American players?
Especially in the last few years for me, The Latin players are, I don't want to say, I don't think hungry is the right word, but they, it's a different today. I mean, you know, when I played, there was no travel ball. There was no, you know, what do they call it? The prospect camps, the showcases. There are no showcases. And to me, watching these kids and getting to see them close up at the academies there, they just want a chance in there, and they'll do anything they can to get themselves better. Not that the Americans don't, but I just think there is a little difference, and there's a lot of great kids from over here that have that work ethic. But there's some, especially the young ones, that, you know, I always said that, you know, the first time they come in, I tell these guys, you know, there's two types of players: those that are humble and those that are about to be humbled, because that's the way it is in this game, no matter how good you are.
Yeah. Now, I know there's a little bit more a lot more that we could discuss about, you know, your coaching in the minors. But I know we're running up on our time here. And before we end, I want to take some time, and I want to devote it to Nanaimo, because you're the supposed to have been last year, but the season got delayed for Canada. But I want to talk about Nanaimo now, and I want to make that transition into Nanaimo for you for coaching. My first question is, why Nanaimo? Like, why coach for them?
Because they asked me. a friend of mine who was a scouting director with the Phillies when I was pitching coordinator, Marty Wolover, who's now with the Cubs, but he's also with Detroit. At the same time, Jim was doing some part-time scouting for Detroit. And so I was talking to Marty during the pandemic, and this is right after, this is probably, the Padres let me know at the end of 2020, when my contract ran out in October, that they weren't going to bring us back, a bunch of us back. And so I was talking to Marty, and he goes, well, you know, there's this, he brought up Jim's name. He goes, there's this town up there, up in Canada. I think you do great up there. And he gave me Jim's number, and I called Jim and told him that Marty, you know, told him to give you a call. And we talked for a while, and they didn't have anything because he had a pitching coach. But we had a real nice talk, and we had, you know, like, his wife's from Saskatchewan. Jim went to Saskatoon. My wife's from Saskatchewan. So there's a lot of, you know, like I said, I'm half Canadian, but nothing was available. He goes, I'll ask around the league. And then a couple weeks later, he called. This is after the first year. He said that their pitching coach was going to go, took a job somewhere else in Tennessee or somewhere. And he goes, but you want to do the job here? I said, sure. And it's a good opportunity for, you know, I started, you know, playing in Canada in 73 and coming full circle almost 50 years later to coach in Nanaimo. And I knew, I mean, you know, I knew of Nanaimo because my wife, you know, we got married in 94 and she was making Nanaimo bars back then. So I knew what a Nanaimo bar was anyway. Mm-hmm. And I'd spent a lot of my summers in Canada. So it sounded like a fun, plus the fact that there's a bunch of teams that are close to Portland where my grandsons are. My oldest grandson's 7. My son-in-law is 6'7". I'm 6'4". This kid's already, you know, 7 years old. He's towers over everybody, left-handed pitcher, plays bat. I mean, really athletic. So the fact that he can, last time he saw me in uniform, he was 4. So now it's 7. He'll be able to maybe appreciate it a little more. And, but the bottom line was I still enjoy working with the young players. I would like to think I can still relate to them and get through to them. As long as we don't talk about music, we'll be fine. but it's gonna be a challenge. I've got a chance to talk with Greg quite a bit. And then my daughter got married in Clearwater Beach a couple weeks ago because we had so many spring training there. She's a teacher in New York. And Greg was about an hour and a half from there. We had lunch our last day there. So we got a chance to talk, meet each other in person. And so I'm looking forward to working with him. And then our new coach, Sean Fitzgerald, who I'm looking forward to, to work with him. I've talked to him a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And so it's the challenge of it. And we'll see at the end of the year. I mean, if they like what I do, I'm not worried about not liking what I'm doing. I know there's gonna be some nice long bus rides.
Yeah.
But in my career, I probably log enough bus miles to go to the moon and back.
So are you going to be the Crash Davis of the team? Bring your guitar.
be Crash Davis's grandfather, probably.
Yeah, I've been to the show. what are you looking forward most to this upcoming season with the Night Owls?
For me, probably just getting back on the field. It's been, the last close to 20 years, I've basically been a coordinator, which, especially for the Phillies, my job was to go around to all the minor leaguers, all the minor league teams, and evaluate the coaches and evaluate the pitchers, set up spring training, be the go-between between the pitching, big league pitching coach and what the needs are and what we have available, working with the farm director. It was a great job. I loved it. And I got to come home every couple of weeks, but I haven't had, my set of pitching. I haven't had a pitching staff on my own for a long time. And I'm looking forward to that challenge of doing that. That's the biggest part, and just getting involved in the game again and seeing if what I've learned and what I feel like I'm done learning every time to get out, and I'm constantly, we got certified in Rapsodo that year of the pandemic. And then when I was going to apply with and use it a lot, they didn't bring me back. So I didn't get a chance to really do it on the field much, but I'm looking for, and I understand the analytics. I understand spin rate. Back then, we used to say when a guy had late life in the zone, that translates to spin rate. Because we didn't know any better. It was just the ball looked like it did something at the end. And we used our eyes to tell us that. But with the technology today, the biggest thing with technology today is, before you used to, 30 years ago, I think you're doing this, where now with the things we have, the technology we have, we can point it out, no, this is what you're doing. And so that part of it will be good. And I'm sure some of these kids will know a lot more than I know about some of that stuff. I feel like my strength will be, the mental part and preparation part. And in the short season I've been talking to a lot of their coaches. I want them to know that, I want to win. Greg wants to win. But I've been in development for 35 years, and I just, to make it simple, I want these guys to be better in August than they were when they came in June. And if we can do that, it makes them better for their team. And I feel like regardless of what the results are, we've accomplished something.
What's something from, because I like to get into leadership, because I feel like you're not only teaching them the game of baseball, but you're also working on teaching them life skills. So, and I like that you just brought up that point. So what's something that you hope that they take away with beyond baseball from you when they leave and go back to their respective schools?
Well, that, you can only do, you can only get the most out of your ability. You can't do more than that. I think one of the more common flaws of the athlete is trying to do more than they're capable of doing. Because we're human. I mean, that's what we do. And that's why I understand the statement, but I'm not a big fan of give me 120% or give me 110%. I don't think it exists. I think that's, I try to stress just give me the best you got. Don't try to do more than that. Just give me the best you got. And I think if you do that, and that goes doesn't mean when you toe the rubber, you get in the batter's box. That means, getting your rest, watching, having fun, but knowing what your priorities are, doing your work to get yourself ready for the game and the preparation part. If we can look in the mirror and say, I did everything I absolutely could to be the best player I could, and that wasn't good enough, I really believe that's going to allow, but having that knowing that you did that, that's going to allow you to be successful in whatever you do in your life after that. Mm-hmm. And it's just being able to, you know, if you're gonna do something, do the best you possibly can.
Yeah.
And I use the line sometimes with these guys is, you know, when you're on the mound, give me your video game focus. Because I've seen them on video games. I mean, they're locked in.
Yeah. Well, we're at the date that we're recording this, which is May 11th, we are just under 3 weeks now to the inaugural game in Portland for the Nanaimo Night Owls against the Portland Pickles in the West Coast League for a 3-game series, May 31st, June 1st, 2nd. When are you officially reporting for duty for the Night Owls?
We're going to drive up because we have a dog, so we can't leave the dog here. So we're going to drive up and try to get up there by the, you know, the kids, the players reporting the 28th. The ones that are, I mean, we're going to be short some players, like I'm sure every club in the league will be in the same boat. And then we're going to work out 29th and 30th. So I'm hoping to get there by the 27th and have a day to kind of get settled a little bit, work out 29th, 30th. And then I guess we're getting on that bus real early in the morning to get on that ferry to bus over to Portland. Well, okay. while you're sleeping, getting ready for the game, we'll be on the bus.
Yes. Well, I'd probably be working, but that's going to be a great series. My understanding is you're going to be the head coach that series because Coach Frady, his daughter, I believe, is also getting married. So he will not be making that first series. So you're going to be the head ball coach that series. Looking forward to that. Got any bugs in this system? Any butterflies? Like, you excited about it?
I'm excited about it. I can't say I really had any butterflies yet. Probably will when we get there. But, you know, there's, I'm sure there's going to be some guys, you know, I look at the number and I look at, okay, so-and-so, okay, you go play. Cause it's going to be, you know, that's one of my big goals in these next 10 days. And then, I mean, I'm going to try to have pictures and names, put them on here, but at least by the time we are done with that series, if not sooner, to be able to know everybody's name and put the face with a name and you know, because I've talked to a bunch of guys now, I've talked to a bunch of coaches. Because I think that relationship you have between them, I think, you know, my job is to get the most out of their ability. And to do that, I think for a player, they got to be relaxed and comfortable. And that's what I'm going to try to do.
Mm-hmm. So, what, you know, for those players that might listen to this, that are going to be there with you, what are some words that you could share with them ahead of time so that way they can take whatever into going into that first series with them that you want them to know?
Yeah, I really haven't thought about that. But I think the one thing would be just, you know, the pitchers attack the zone. Don't be afraid of contact. Position players show up for every pitch. Show up for every single pitch. If we can do that, I'll take my chances. I mean, if you look at it, if I got the 7 guys behind me, and you know, it takes probably from the time the pitcher gets his delivery to the fielder being ready to field a pitch, it's probably 3 to 4 seconds. So it's 3 seconds. You know, times 100 is 300. That's 5 minutes. I'm asking them to concentrate, to show up for every single pitch. Be have that attitude that, no, I don't care what happened to your bat, but have the attitude that ball is being hit to me. Anticipate that ball being hit to you. And if I get everybody doing that, then like I said, we'll take our chances.
Excellent. Well, Coach, I look forward to being able to meet you in person there at the end of May, beginning of June. It'll be great. And I also look forward to being there and experiencing the Nanaimo Bars/Owls opening series. And so thankful for you having taken your time on this inning of Cole Ball to spend with us so that way we get to know you better as an individual. So I appreciate that.
Thank you. And I appreciate the, you know, you asking me, and I also appreciate, it's obvious you did your homework, and that's nice. I mean, it makes it easy easier for me to answer questions because I know that you've taken the time to, you know, to put some work into it. And I appreciate that. And just don't mess up at first base. That's all I can say. No, we'll have some fun. We'll have a lot of fun. And, you know, I like to have fun. I'm not a, you know, I mean, I get that German temper every once in a while, but I'm pretty easygoing as long as they go out there and play the game the right way. Mm-hmm. And play the game the right way, play hard and get beat. We'll get in tomorrow.
Excellent. Well, thank you again, Coach, for joining us. Corbin Haymiller, awesome episode, awesome inning of Cole Ball. That'll do it for this inning of Cole Ball. However, we are not done yet. We will be back with yet another extra inning of Cole Ball and more extra innings ahead. So thank you for wherever you are at. Thank you for listening to Cole Ball and making this an amazing series. You have yourself a great day and peace out.